Mom, you missed the turn.
Lydia tapped the brakes. She checked the mirrors and backed up. A car swerved around her, horn blaring. Dee's thumbs blurred across the bottom of her phone.
You're going to end up killing yourself in a car accident, and I'm going to be an orphan.
Lydia had only herself to blame for this kind of hyperbole. She drove around the school and pulled into a parking space in the back. Instead of the Valhalla that was the Westerly Intramural Sporting Complex, the gym behind Booker T. Washington High School in downtown Atlanta was a 1920s red brick structure that more closely resembled the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. Lydia scanned the parking lot because that's what she always did before she unlocked the doors.
I'll get a ride home from Bella.
Dee grabbed her gym bag off the back seat.
See you tonight.
I need to go in. Dee looked horrified by the prospect.
Mom, you said
I need to go to the bathroom. Dee got out of the car.
You pee all the time.
Thank you for that. Between 32 hours of labor and the looming specter of menopause, Lydia was lucky her bladder wasn't hanging between her knees like a cow's udder. She turned around to retrieve her purse from the back seat. Lydia stayed there, making sure Dee went into the building. And then she heard the click of the driver's side door opening. Instinctively, Lydia swung around with her fists up, screaming,
No! Lydia!
Penelope Ward had her arms over her head.
It's me!
Lydia wondered if it was too late to punch her. Penelope said,
Gosh, I didn't mean to scare you.
I'm fine. Lydia lied. Her heart was down by her bladder. I was just dropping off Dee. I can't talk right now. I have a funeral to go to.
Oh, no. Whose?
Lydia hadn't thought that far ahead. A friend, an old teacher, Miss Clavel. She was really talking too much. That's all there is. There isn't any more.
Okay, but a quick word.
Penelope was still blocking the open door.
Remember how I told you about the International Festival?
Lydia bumped the gear into reverse.
Just send me whatever recipe you want and I'll... Super! You'll have it by 3 o'clock today.
Penelope was good about setting her own deadlines.
But listen, are you still in touch with the band?
Lydia edged her foot toward the gas.
It jogged my memory when you said you grew up in Athens. I went to UGA.
Lydia should have guessed by the pastel sweater sets and blowjobby pucker to her lips.
I saw you perform a zillion times. Liddy and the Spoons, right? God, those were the days. Whatever happened to those gals? Probably ended up married with a ton of kids, am I right?
Yep. If you mean incarcerated, divorced 4 times, and keeping a punch card in her wallet from the Women's Health Center so she can get her 10th abortion for free. We're all just a bunch of old ladies.
So, Penelope was still blocking the door. You'll ask them, right? What a kick Dee would get out of seeing her mom on stage.
Oh, she'd be thrilled. I'll email you about it, okay? Lydia had to get out of here with or without the minivan door intact. She eased her foot off the brake. Penelope walked alongside her. Need to go now. Lydia motioned for her to get out of the way. Need to close the door. She tapped her foot on the gas.
Finally, Penelope stepped back so she wouldn't get knocked down. I look forward to receiving your email.
Lydia hit the gas so hard that the minivan lurched. God, this really was her day to have her shitty past dredged up and thrown like a pile of steaming cow manure at her feet. She'd love to get Penelope Ward and the band together. They would eat her alive. Literally. The last time the Spoons had been in the same room together, 2 of them ended up in the hospital with severe bite marks. Was that the first time Lydia had been arrested? It was definitely the first time her father had bailed her out of jail. Sam Carroll had been equal parts mortified and heartbroken. Of course, at that point in his life, there were very few pieces of his heart left that were big enough to shatter. Julia had been gone for 5 years by then. Her father had had 5 years of sleepless nights. 5 years of suspended grief. 5 years of filling his head with all the terrible things that might have been done to his eldest daughter. "Daddy," Lydia sighed. She wished that he had lived long enough to see Lydia straightened out. She really wished that he'd met Dee. He would have loved her dry sense of humor. And maybe, knowing Dee, holding his granddaughter in his arms, would have kept his poor, broken heart beating a few more years. Lydia stopped at a red light. There was a McDonald's on the right. Lydia still needed to go to the bathroom, but she knew if she went inside, she'd order everything on the menu. She stared at the light until it turned. Her foot went to the gas. 15 more minutes passed before she pulled into the Magnolia Hills Memorial Gardens. She told Penelope Ward that she was going to a funeral, but she felt more like she was going to a birthday party. Her birthday party. The Lydia who didn't have to worry about Paul Scott anymore was officially 4 days old. She should have brought a hat. The rain picked up as soon as Lydia stepped out of the van. She popped open the back and found an umbrella that would open. The hem of her dress wicked up rainwater. She scanned the cemetery, which was garden-like and hilly with lots of magnolias, just as advertised. She pulled a sheet of paper out of her purse. Lydia loved the Internet. She could Google Earth the mothers' houses, look up how much they'd paid for their idiotic designer outfits, and, more important to today's task, print out a map leading to Paul Scott's gravesite. The walk was longer than she had anticipated, and of course, the rain got worse the farther she got from her van. After 10 minutes of following what turned out to be a very inaccurate map, Lydia realized she was lost. She took out her phone and Googled the information again. Then she tried to map her location. The flashing blue dot said she needed to go to the north. Lydia turned north, she walked a few feet, and the blue dot indicated she needed to go south. "For fuck's sakes," Lydia mumbled, but then her eye caught a headstone 2 rows over. Scott. Paul had grown up just outside of Athens, but his father's people were from Atlanta. His parents were buried alongside Scott's going back several generations. He had once told Lydia that Scott's had even fought on both sides of the Civil War. So he came by his duplicity honestly. Paul's grave had a tiny marker that looked more like a stake you'd use to label a vegetable garden. Sugar snap peas, cabbage, sadistic prick. Lydia supposed his headstone had been ordered. Something large and garish, made of the finest marble, and phallic-shaped because being dead didn't stop you from being a dick. Last night, while Lydia was watching TV with Rick, she had zoned out, picturing herself standing by Paul's grave. She hadn't anticipated the rain, so in her mind, the sun was happily shining in the sky and bluebirds sat on her shoulder. Likewise, she had never considered the freshly dug red Georgia clay would be covered by astroturf. The fake grass was the kind of thing you saw at a putt-putt course or on the balcony of a cheap motel. Paul would have hated it. Which is why she couldn't help smiling. "Okay," Lydia said, because she hadn't come here to smile. She took a deep breath and slowly let it go. She pressed her hand to her chest to still her heart, and then she started talking. "You were wrong," she told Paul, because he had been a pedantic asshole who thought he was right about everything. "You said I would be dead in a gutter by now. You said I was worthless. You said that no one would believe me because I didn't matter." Lydia looked up at the dark sky. Drops of rain tapped insistently against the umbrella. "And I believed you for so many years because I thought I'd done something wrong," thought, she repeated silently, because she knew that no one could punish her as viciously as she punished herself. I didn't lie. I didn't make it up. But I let myself think that you did it because I asked for it. That I'd sent you the wrong signals, that you only attacked me because you thought I wanted it. Lydia wiped tears from her eyes. She had never in her life wanted anything less than Paul's advances. And then I finally realized that what you did wasn't my fault. That you were just a cold, psychotic motherfucker and you found the perfect way to push me out of my own family. She wiped her nose with the back of her hand. And you know what? Fuck you, Paul. Fuck you and your stupid piece of shit Miata and your goddamn graduate degree and your blood money from your parents' car accident. And look who's standing here now, asshole. Look who got gutted in an alley like a pig and look who's dancing on your fucking grave. Lydia was practically breathless from finally getting it all out. Her heart was pounding in her chest. She felt hollow, but not from her outburst. There had to be something else. For so many years, she dreamed of confronting Paul, taking him down, beating him with her fists or kicking him with her feet or stabbing him with a rusty knife. Words were not enough. There had to be something more to do than just scream at his grave. She looked out at the cemetery as if an idea would strike her like lightning. Rain was coming down so hard that the air had taken on a white haze. The ground was saturated. Lydia dropped her umbrella. The ground could probably be wetter. Her bladder was still full. Nothing would give her greater pleasure than pissing on Paul's grave. She yanked back the green carpet. She hiked up her dress and bent over so she could pull down her underwear. And then she stopped because she wasn't alone. Lydia noticed the shoes first. Black Louboutins, approximately $5,000. Sheer hose, though who the hell wore pantyhose anymore? Black dress, probably Armani or Gaultier, at least another $6,000. There were no rings on the woman's elegant fingers, nor a tasteful tennis bracelet on her bird-like wrists. Her shoulders were square, and her posture was ramrod straight, which told Lydia that Helen's admonitions had been followed by at least one of her daughters. Well, Claire crossed her arms low on her waist. This is awkward. It certainly is. Lydia hadn't seen her baby sister in 18 years, though in her wildest imagination, she had never dreamed that Claire would turn into a mother. Here. Claire snapped open her $2,000 Prada clutch and pulled out a handful of Kleenex. She tossed the tissues in Lydia's general direction. There was no graceful way to do this. Lydia's underwear was down around her knees. Do you mind turning around? Of course. Where are my manners? Claire turned around. The black dress was tailored to her perfect figure. Her shoulder blades stuck out like cut glass. Her arms were toned little sticks. She probably jogged with her trainer every morning and played tennis every afternoon, and then bathed in rose water milked from a magic unicorn before her husband came home every night. Not that Paul Scott was ever coming home again. Lydia pulled up her underwear as she stood. She blew her nose into the tissue, then dropped it on Paul's grave. She kicked the astroturf back in place like a cat in a litter box. This was fun. Lydia grabbed her umbrella and made to leave. Let's never do it again. Claire spun around. Don't you dare slink off. Slink? The word was like a match to kindling. You think I'm slinking away from you? I literally stopped you from pissing on my husband's grave.
Lydia couldn't talk in italics anymore. You'd better be glad I didn't take a shit.
God, you're so crass.
And you're a fucking bitch.
Lydia turned on her heel and headed toward the van. Don't walk away from me.
Lydia cut between the graves because she knew Claire's heels would sink into the wet grass.
Come back here.
Claire was keeping up. She had taken off her shoes.
Lydia, goddammit, stop!
What?
Lydia swung around so fast that the umbrella swiped Claire's head.
What do you want from me, Claire?
You made your choice, you and Mom both. You can't just expect me to forgive you now that he's dead. It doesn't change anything.
Forgive me?
Claire was so outraged that her voice trilled. You think I'm the one who needs forgiveness?
I told you that your husband tried to rape me, and your response was that I needed to get the fuck out of your house before you called the police.
Mom didn't believe you either.
Mom didn't believe you either,
Lydia mocked. Mom thought you were still a virgin in the 8th grade.
You don't know a goddamn thing about me.
I know you chose a guy you'd been screwing for 2 seconds over your own sister.
Was this before or after you stole all the cash from my wallet, or from under my mattress, or from my jewelry box, or lied to me about borrowing my car? Or told me you didn't pawn Daddy's stethoscope, but then Mom got a call from the pawn shop because they recognized his name?
Claire wiped rain out of her eyes. I know it was before you stole my credit card and ran up $13,000 in debt.
How was Amsterdam, Lydia? Did you enjoy all the coffee shops?
I did, actually.
Lydia still had the little canal house souvenir the KLM stewardess had given her in first class.
How did you enjoy knowing you turned your back on the last sister you have left?
Claire's mouth snapped into a thin line. Her eyes took on a heated gleam.
God, you look just like Mom when you do that.
Shut up.
That's mature.
Lydia could hear the immaturity in her own voice.
This is idiotic. We're having the same argument we had 18 years ago, except this time we're doing it in the rain.
Claire looked down at the ground. For the first time, she seemed uncertain of herself. You lied to me all the time about everything.
You think I'd lie about that?
You were stoned out of your mind when he drove you home.
Is that what Paul told you? Because he picked me up from jail. You're not usually stoned in jail. That's kind of a no-no.
I've been to jail, Lydia. People who want to get high find a way to get high.
Lydia snorted a laugh. Her goody-two-shoes baby sister had been to jail like Lydia had been to the moon.
Claire said, he wasn't even attracted to you.
Lydia studied her face. This was an old line of reasoning, but she was saying it with less conviction. You're doubting him.
No, I'm not.
Claire pushed her wet hair back off her face.
You're just hearing what you want to hear, like you always do.
Claire was lying. Lydia could feel it in her bones. She was standing there getting soaked in the rain and lying. Did Paul hurt you? Is that what this is about? You couldn't say it when he was alive, but now...
He never hurt me. He was a good husband. A good man. He took care of me. He made me feel safe. He loved me.
Lydia didn't respond. Instead, she let the silence build. She still didn't believe her sister. Claire was just as easy to read now as when she was a little kid. Something was really bothering her, and that something obviously had to do with Paul. Her eyebrows were doing a weird zig, the same way Helen's did when she was upset. They hadn't spoken in nearly 2 decades, but Lydia knew that confronting Claire
always made her dig in her heels deeper. She tried a diversion. Are you following this Anna Kilpatrick thing? Claire snorted as if the answer was obvious. Of course I am. Mom is too.
Mom is?
Lydia was genuinely surprised.
She told you that?
No, but I know she's following it. Claire took a deep breath, then let it go. She looked up at the sky. The rain had stopped. She's not heartless, Lydia. She had her own way of dealing with it. She left the rest of the sentence unsaid. Dad had his own way of dealing with it, too. Lydia busied herself with closing her umbrella. The canopy was white, with various breeds of dogs jumping in circles around the ferrule. Her father had carried something similar back when he could still hold down his job teaching vet students at UGA. Claire said, I'm Mom's age now. Lydia looked up at her sister. 38. The same age Mom was when Julia went missing. And Julia would be 43. Every year, Lydia marked Julia's birthday, and Helen's, and Claire's, and the day that Julia had disappeared. Claire let out another shaky breath. Lydia resisted the urge to do the same. Paul hadn't just taken away Claire all those years ago. He'd taken away the connection that came from looking into someone else's eyes and knowing that they understood exactly what you were feeling. Claire asked, Did you have kids?
No,
Lydia lied.
You?
Paul wanted to, but I was terrified of... She didn't have to put a name to the terror. If family planning was the sort of thing Lydia had been capable of in her 20s, there was no way in hell she would have had Dee. Watching how the loss of a child had pulled her parents apart, not just pulled them apart, but destroyed them, had been enough of a cautionary tale. Claire said, Grandma Jenny has dementia. She's forgotten how to be mean.
Do you remember what she said to me at Dad's funeral?
Claire shook her head.
You're fat again. I guess that means you're not taking drugs.
Claire took in Lydia's shape, leaving the obvious question unspoken. 17 and a half years sober.
Good for you.
There was a catch in her voice. She was crying. Lydia suddenly realized that, despite the designer outfit, her sister looked like hell. Her dress had obviously been slept in. She had a cut on her cheek, a black bruise was under her ear. Her nose was bright red. The rain had soaked her through. She was shivering from the cold. Claire.
I have to go.
Claire started walking toward her car.
Take care of yourself, Pepper.
She left before Lydia could think of a reason for her not to. Part 3.
The sheriff arrested me today. He said that I was interfering with his investigation. My defense, that I could not interfere with something that did not exist, left him unmoved. Years ago, to help raise money for the local humane shelter, I volunteered myself to be pretend arrested at the county fair. While you and your little sister were playing skee-ball, Pepper was grounded for mouthing off to a teacher. All of us villains were held in a roped-off part of the fair while we waited for our significant others to bail us out. This time, as with the pretend time, your mother bailed me out. Sam, she said, you can't keep doing this. When she's anxious, your mother twists her new wedding ring around her finger. And every time I see this, I can't help but feel she is trying to twist it off. Have I ever told you just how much I love your mother? She is the most remarkable woman I have ever known. Your grandmother thought she was a gold digger, though there was hardly a scrap of silver in my pocket when we first met. Everything she said and did delighted me. I loved the books she read. I loved the way her mind worked. I loved that she looked at me and saw something that I had only ever glimpsed in myself. I would have given up without her. Not on you. Never on you, but on myself. I suppose I can tell you this now, but I wasn't a very good student. I wasn't smart enough to just get by. I wasn't focused enough in class. I rarely passed exams. I skipped assignments. I was constantly on academic probation. Not that your grandmother would ever know, but at the time, I was thinking of doing what you were later accused of doing. Selling all my belongings, sticking out my thumb and hitchhiking to California to be with the other hippies who had dropped out and tuned in. Everything changed when I met your mother. She made me want things that I had never dreamed of wanting. A steady job, a reliable car, a mortgage, a family. You figured out a long time ago that you got your wanderlust from me. I want you to know that this is what happens when you meet the person you are supposed to spend the rest of your life with. That restless feeling dissolves like butter. I think what breaks my heart the most is that you will never learn that for yourself. I want you to know that your mother has not forgotten you. Not a morning passes that she does not wake up thinking about you. She marks your birthdays in her own way. Every March 4th, the anniversary of your disappearance, she walks the same path you might have walked when you left the Manhattan Cafe that night. She leaves a nightlight burning in your old room. She refuses to sell the house on Boulevard because, despite her protests, she still holds out the slim hope that one day you might come walking back up the sidewalk and find your way home. "I want to feel normal again," she once told me. "Maybe if I pretend I am long enough, it might actually happen." Your mother is one of the strongest, smartest women I have ever met. But losing you cleaved her in two. The vibrant, caustic, witty, contrary woman I married splintered off into silence. She would tell you she gave in to mourning you for too long, let the pity and self-hate drag her into that black pit that I still crawl around in. If she did, her stay there was temporary. Somehow, she managed to wrench a piece of her former self out of the ground. She tells me that the other, miserable half, the chipped-off, cast-off half, still follows at a respectful distance, ready to take over the second she stumbles. Only through sheer strength of will does she manage to never stumble. When your mother told me she was marrying another man, she said, "I can't sacrifice the two daughters I have left for the one that I'll never see again." She didn't say that she loved this man. She didn't say that he moved her or that she needed him. She said that she needed the things that he could offer. Stability, companionship, a glass of wine at night without the drowning sense of sorrow. I do not resent this other man for taking my place. I do not hate him because I do not want your sisters to hate him. It is remarkably easy for a divorced parent to make remarriage a smooth transition for his or her children. You just keep your mouth shut and let them know that everything is going to be all right. and I really feel that it will be, at least for the remaining part of my family. Your mother has always been a good judge of character. This man she chose is kind to your sisters. He goes to Pepper's riotous, perplexing concerts and pays attention to Claire. I cannot begrudge him attending PTA meetings and carving pumpkins and putting up Christmas trees. They visit your sisters once a month in Auburn. I know, sweetheart, but they couldn't go to UGA because it reminded them too much of you. I cannot blame your mother for moving on while I stayed rooted in the past. I have widowed her. I would just as soon ask her to stay with me as I would ask her to lay with me in my grave. I suppose the sheriff called her to bail me out because, left to my own devices, I would have stayed in the cell until he was forced to either arraign me or let me go. I was trying to make a point. Your mother agreed, if I meant that the point I was making was that I am a stubborn asshole. You, of all people, will know that this exchange means that she still loves me. But she has also made it clear that this is it for her. She no longer wants to hear about my wild goose chases, or my crazy searches, or my meeting strangers in dark corners and interrogating young women who knew you back then but are now married and gainfully employed and trying to start families of their own. Should I fault her for this? Should I blame her for giving up on my windmills? Here is why I was arrested. There is a man who works at the taco stand. He's the manager now, but he was bussing tables the day you disappeared. The sheriff's men cleared his alibi, but one of your friends, Carrie LaScala, told me that she'd overheard this man at a party talking about how he saw you on the street the night of March 4th, 1991. Any father would seek out this man. Any father would follow him down the street, let him know what it felt like to have someone behind you who was stronger and angrier and had an agenda that involved taking you somewhere more private. Which sounds like harassment, but feels like investigating a crime. Your mother pointed out that the taco man could hire a lawyer. That the next time the Huckleberries come, it could be with a warrant. Huckleberries. This was one of your mother's words. She gave Sheriff Carl Huckabee the nickname during the third week of the investigation, and by the third month, she had extrapolated it to everyone in uniform. You might remember the sheriff from that day at the carnival. He is a clumsy Barney Fife type, with a stiff mustache he keeps trimmed in a straight line, and sideburns he grooms so often you can see the furrows left by the teeth of his comb. This is what Huckleberry believes. The taco man was with his grandmother at her nursing home the night you went missing. There was no sign-in sheet at the front desk, no log, no cameras, no other witnesses but his grandmother and a nurse who checked the old woman's catheter around 11 that evening. You were last seen at 10:38 p.m. The nurse claims that the taco man was asleep in the chair beside his grandmother's bed when you were taken. And yet, Carrie LaScala says that she heard him say otherwise. Your mother would call this kind of thinking crazy-making. And maybe she's right. I no longer tell your sisters about my leads. The taco man, the garbage man who was arrested for flashing a grade schooler, the gardener peeping Tom, the night manager at the 7-Eleven who was caught molesting his niece are all strangers to them. I've moved my collection of clues into the bedroom so they won't see it when they visit. Not that they visit much, though I cannot blame them. They are young women now. They are building their lives. Claire is around the same age as you were when we lost you. Pepper is older, though not wiser. I see her making so many mistakes. The drugs, the uncaring and unavailable boyfriends, the anger that burns so hot she could light an entire city. But I feel like I don't have the authority to stop her. Your mother says that all we can do is be there for Pepper when she falls. Maybe she's right. And maybe she's right to be worried about this new man in Claire's life. He tries too hard. He pleases too much. Is it our place to tell her? Or will she figure it out on her own? Or will he? She has your Grandma Jenny's wandering eye. It's strange that your mother and I are only ever whole when we talk about your sister's lives. We are both of us too wounded to talk about our own. The open sores of our hearts fester if we are together too long. I know your mother looks at me and sees playhouses I built and touch football games I played and homework I helped with and the millions of times I lifted you in my arms and swung you around like a doll. Just as when I look at her, I see the growing swell of her belly, the gentle look on her face when she rocked you to sleep, the panic in her eyes when your fever spiked and you had to have your tonsils out, and the vexed expression she would get when she realized that you had out-argued her. I know that your mother belongs to another man now, that she has created a stable life for my children, that she has managed to move on. But when I kiss her, she never resists. And when I hold her, she holds me back. And when we make love, it is my name she whispers. In that moment, we are finally able to remember all of the good things we had together instead of everything that we have lost.
Chapter 5. Claire was still soaking wet from her graveside confrontation with Lydia. She sat shivering in the middle of the garage, holding a broken tennis racket in her hand. Her weapon of choice. It was the fourth tennis racket she had broken in as many minutes. There wasn't a cabinet or a tool or a car in the garage that hadn't met the hard edge of a graphite tennis racket. Bosworth Tennis Tour 96S, custom designed to Claire's stroke. $400 a pop. She rolled her wrist, which was going to need ice. The hand was already showing a bruise. Her throat was raw from screaming. She stared at her reflection in the side mirror, dangling from Paul's Porsche. Her wet hair was plastered to the shape of her skull. She was wearing the same dress she'd worn to the funeral yesterday afternoon. Her waterproof mascara had finally given up the ghost. Her lipstick had long been chewed off. Her skin was sallow. She could not remember the last time she had lost her shit like this. Even on the day she'd ended up in jail, Claire had not lost this volume of shit. She closed her eyes and breathed in the silence of the large room. The BMW's engine was cooling. She could hear it clicking. Her heart was giving 6 beats for every 1 click. She put her hand to her chest and wondered if it was possible for your heart to explode. Last night, Claire had gone to bed expecting nightmares. But instead of dreaming about being chained to a concrete wall, the masked man coming for her, Claire's brain had given her something far worse. A highlight reel of some of her most tender moments with Paul. The time she'd twisted her ankle in St. Martin, and he'd driven all over the island looking for a doctor. The time he'd scooped her up with the intention of carrying her upstairs, but because of his bad back, ended up making love to her on the landing. The time she'd woken up from knee surgery to find a smiley face drawn on the bandage around her leg. Could the man who still, almost 20 years into their marriage, left notes on her coffee cup with an actual heart with their initials inside, really be the same man who downloaded that movie onto his computer? Claire looked down at the broken racket. So much money. And the sad truth was that she really preferred a $60 Wilson. Back when she and Paul were students, they always made lists when they couldn't figure out what to do. Paul would get a ruler and draw a line down the center of the page. On one side, they would list reasons they should do something, buy something, try something. On the other side, they would write the reasons not to. Claire pulled herself up to standing. She tossed the racket onto the Porsche's hood. Paul kept a notepad and pen on his workbench. She drew a line down the center of a blank page. Paul would have broken out into a sweat over that line. It veered to the left, toward the bottom. The pen had skipped off the page, curling up the edge. Claire tapped the pen on the side of the bench. She stared at the two empty columns. There were no pros and cons. This list was for questions and answers. The first question was, had Paul really downloaded the movie? Claire had to assume that he had. Accidentally downloading files with viruses and spyware was Claire's thing. Paul was too careful to accidentally download anything. And if by some off chance he had downloaded the movie by mistake, he would have deleted the file rather than storing it in his work folder. And he would have told Claire about it, because that's the kind of relationship they had. Or at least, it was the kind of relationship she'd thought they'd had. She wrote the word accident in one column and no in the other. Claire started tapping the pen again. Could it be that Paul had downloaded the movie for the sadomasochism, then not realized until he got to the end that it was more than that? She shook her head. Paul was so straight-laced that he tucked his undershirt into his boxers before he went to bed at night. If someone had told her last week that her husband was into S&M, after she choked down her laughter, Claire would have assumed that Paul would be a bottom. Not that he was passive in their sex life. Claire was the one more likely to just lie there, but sexual fantasies were projections of opposites. Paul was in control all of the time, so his fantasy would be to let someone else take over. Claire certainly had daydreams about being tied up and ravished by a stranger, but in the cold light of day, that sort of thing was terrifying. And besides that, a few years ago when she'd read Paul several passages from 50 Shades of Grey, they'd both giggled like teenagers. "The biggest fantasy in that book," Paul had said, "is that he changes for her in the end." Claire had never thought of herself as an expert in male behavior, but Paul had a point. And not just about men. People did not change their basic, core personalities. Their values tended to stay the same, their personal demeanors, their world outlook and political beliefs. One need only go to a high school reunion to verify the theory. So, going by this, it made no sense that the man who had cried when their cat had to be put down, who refused to watch scary movies, who joked that Claire was on her own if an axe murderer ever broke into the house, would be the same man who derived sexual pleasure from watching horrible, unspeakable acts. Claire looked down at the notepad. She wrote, "More files?" Because that was the dark thought lurking in the back of her mind. The file name had been a series of numbers, and all of the files she'd seen in the work folder were similarly numbered. Had Paul downloaded more of these disgusting movies? Was that how he spent his time when he told Claire he'd been working late in his office? She wasn't a Pollyanna about these things. She knew men watched pornography. Claire herself wasn't adverse to the softcore sex of a pay cable show. The thing was that their sex life had been fairly tame. They'd try different positions or variations on a theme, but after 18 years, they knew what worked, and they stuck with the old standards. Which was likely why Claire had ended up taking Adam Quinn up on his offer last year at the company Christmas party. Claire loved her husband, but sometimes she craved variety. Was Paul the same? She had never considered the possibility that she wasn't enough for him. He had always been so smitten with her. Paul was the one who reached down to hold her hand in the car. He was the one who sat close to her at dinners and put his arm around her at movies and watched her cross the room at parties. Even in bed, he was never pleased until she was. He rarely asked Claire to use her mouth on him, and he was never an asshole about it. Back when she still had friends, they had jealously teased her about Paul's devotion. Had that been for show? Through all the seemingly happy years of their marriage, had Paul yearned for something more? And did he find that something more in the disgusting contents of that movie? Claire wrote down another question. Is it real? The production had an amateurish feel, but that could have been on purpose. Computers were capable of amazing things. If they could make it look like Michael Jackson was dancing on stage, they could make it look like a woman was being murdered. The pen was tapping again. Claire watched it bounce between her fingers. The workbench top was bamboo. The damn thing had proven to be indestructible. She'd been half tempted to take a page from Lydia's book and piss all over it. Lydia. God, what an unexpected slap in the face to see her sister after all these years. She would not be telling her mother about the meeting. Mostly because Helen had enough to fret over between Paul's murder and the burglary. Besides, the irony was not lost on Claire that less than a year after her family broke ties, Lydia had finally managed to get herself clean. Between looking for Julia and paying bail bondsmen and lawyers and rehab clinics for Lydia's upkeep, Sam Carroll had been nearly bankrupt when he'd finally taken his life. For that sin alone, Claire should have cut off her sister. But then, she'd accused Paul of trying to rape her. And that had been the final straw. "Did Paul hurt you?" Lydia had asked, standing less than 10 yards from Paul's grave. "Is that what this is about?" Claire knew what the "this" was. It was doubt. She was doubting her husband because of what she'd found on his computer. Her mind had made the leap from Paul watching violence to actually committing it, which was a stupid connection because millions of young men played violent video games, but only a handful went on spree killings. Then again, Paul had once told her that there was no such thing as coincidence. The law of truly large numbers provides that given a large enough sample size, any outrageous thing can happen. Claire looked down at the 3 items on her list. Accident? More files? Is it real? At the moment, only one of those outrageous questions could be answered. Claire went up the stairs before she could stop herself. She keyed in the code to open the door to Paul's office. Agent Nolan had made a comment about all the codes needed for the house, but Paul had made it easy for Claire by making all the door codes a variation on their birthdays. The office looked the same as it had been the day before. Claire sat down at the desk. She hesitated as she reached out to tap the keyboard. This was a red pill, blue pill moment. Did she really want to know if there were more files?
Paul was dead now. What was the point?
She tapped the keyboard. The point was that she had to know. Claire's hand was surprisingly steady as she moved the mouse to the dock and clicked on the work folder. The rainbow wheel spun, but instead of a list of files, a white box popped up. Connect to Gladiator. There was a yes and no button underneath. Claire wondered why she hadn't been prompted to log in the day before. She had a vague recollection of clicking close on several messages yesterday when Agent Nolan was creeping his way up the stairs. Apparently, one of the things she'd closed was the connection to whatever this Gladiator was. She leaned her elbows on the desk and stared at the words. Was this a sign that she should stop? Paul had trusted her completely. Too completely, going by her affairs, because, of course, Adam Quinn wasn't the first. Or the last, since she was being brutally honest. There was a reason Tim the bartender was estranged from his wife. She tried to summon yesterday's crushing guilt, but the remorse had been sanded down by the rough images she'd found on her husband's computer. Gladiator, Claire said. She didn't know why the word sounded familiar. She rolled the mouse over and clicked on the yes button. The screen changed. A new message popped up. Password? Fuck. How much harder was this going to get? She tapped her finger on the mouse as she stared at the prompt. All of the system passwords were a combination of mnemonics and dates. She typed in YALAPC111176, which stood for You Are Looking at Paul's Computer, followed by his birthday. A black triangle with an exclamation point in the center told her that the password was incorrect. Claire tried a few more variations, using her birthday, their wedding anniversary, the date they first met in the computer lab, the date they first went out, which was also the same day they'd first had sex, because Claire never played hard to get when she'd made up her mind. Nothing worked. She looked around Paul's office, wondering if she was missing something. You are looking at the chair where Paul reads, she tried. You are looking at the couch where Paul naps. Nothing. You are looking at the computer where Paul jerks off. Claire slumped back in the chair. Directly across from Paul's desk was the painting she had given him for their third wedding anniversary. Claire had painted it herself from a photograph of his childhood home. Paul's mother had taken the picture standing in their backyard. The picnic table was set with birthday decorations. Claire wasn't good with faces, so a tiny blob represented a young Paul sitting at the table. He'd told her that the farmer who'd bought the Scott land had torn down the house and all the surrounding structures. Claire couldn't blame the man. The house had a home-built look to it. The wooden paneling ran up and down instead of left to right. The barn in the backyard loomed like the Amityville Horror House. It cast such a dark shadow over the picnic table and old well house that Claire had been forced to guess the colors. Paul had told her she'd gotten them exactly right, though she was fairly certain the little structure over the well should have been green instead of black. Claire typed some more guesses into the computer, speaking aloud so she could get the first letters of each word in the correct order. You are looking at Claire's painting. You are looking at the house where Paul grew up. You are looking at an old well house that should be green. Claire slammed the keyboard tray back into the desk. She was angrier than she'd thought. And realizing she was angry made her realize where she'd seen the word gladiator. Idiot, she whispered. Paul's workbench had a giant metal logo on the side that said Gladiator, the company that had custom-made the piece.
You are looking at Paul's workbench.
Claire added Paul's birth date, then pressed enter. The drive connected. The work files came up. Claire's hand stayed still on the mouse.
Helen had told her a long time ago that knowing the truth wasn't always a good thing. She had been talking about Julia, because that was all her mother was capable of talking about back then. She would stay in bed for weeks, sometimes months, mourning the unexplained disappearance of her oldest child. Lydia had taken over the parenting for a while, and when Lydia had checked out, Grandma Jenny had moved in and terrorized them all into shape. Would Helen want to know where Julia was now? If Claire handed her mother an envelope and inside was the story of exactly what had happened to Julia, would she open it? Claire sure as hell would. She clicked on the second file in the work folder, which, according to the date, Paul had watched the same night as the first. The same woman from the first movie was chained in the same way to the same wall. Claire took in the details of the room. She was definitely looking at an older basement. It was nothing like the pristine, smoothly formed walls in Paul's dream basement. The cinder block wall behind the woman looked dank and wet. There was a stained mattress on the concrete floor. The trash came from fast food restaurants. Old wires and galvanized pipe hung from the ceiling joists. Claire turned the sound back on, but low. The woman was whimpering. A man entered the frame. Claire recognized him as the same man from the other movie. Same mask, same tight leather briefs. He wasn't hard yet. Instead of a machete, he had an electric cattle prod in his hand. Claire waited until he was about to use it, then she paused the movie. She sat back in the chair. The man was frozen, his arm was out. The woman was shrinking away. She knew what was coming. Claire closed the movie. She went back to the files and opened the third one from the top. Same woman, same setup, same man. Claire studied his naked back. She didn't tell herself why until she confirmed there was no constellation of moles under his left shoulder blade, which meant that the man could not be Paul. The relief was so overwhelming that she had to close her eyes and just breathe for a few minutes. Claire opened her eyes. She closed the movie. The file names were in sequences, so she gathered there were 10 more files of the woman in various scenes of torture before the death shot. According to their dates, Paul had watched them all the night before he died. They were each around 5 minutes, which meant he'd spent almost an hour watching the vile images.
No way.
Claire mumbled. She was lucky if Paul lasted more than 10 minutes. Was he watching these movies for something other than sexual pleasure? She scrolled down to the next sequence of files. There were only 5 in this series. Paul had watched the first one 10 days ago. The next was 9 days ago, and so on until the night before Paul had died. She clicked open the most recent movie. Another girl. This one, even younger. Her long, dark hair covered her face. Claire leaned in closer. The girl was pulling at the restraints. She turned her head to the side. Her hair fell away. Her eyes went wide with fear. Claire paused the movie. She didn't want to see the man again. There was another question she should have put on the list. Is this legal? Obviously, that all depended on whether or not it was real. If the police could arrest you for watching fake gore, every